Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Donald Olson. I'm the state senator from the North Slope area as well as the Western Alaska, the rural part of the state. I want to thank the Departments of Biological Health Sciences there at the University of Alaska in Anchorage for sponsoring this event. And a special thanks to Dr. Frank von Hippel, Dr. Fred Rainey, and Dr. Liz Snyder for their support on this lecture. I'd also like to thank and acknowledge those people on the ACAT staff who worked so hard to make this lecture series possible. Antonio Ogula, Mary Carmen Cruz, Jolte, I'm sorry, I'm having trouble with these names, Holly Kent, Heather McLaughlin, Samasmary Medina, Patty Saunders, and Vi Wiley. I went ahead and sponsored Senate Bill 151, which has to do with the Toxics-Free Chemical Children's Act. And so this afternoon, I'm very pleased to introduce Dr. Tracy Woodruff, a national leader in the field of science for environmental health and policy. Dr. Woodruff is a professor in the Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences at the University of California in San Francisco, and is the director of the Program on Reproductive Health and Environment. She has extensive expertise in environmental health research and public policy, with a particular emphasis on early life development. Her research areas include perinatal health effects from air pollution, developing the first national characterization of air toxics across the United States, children's health risks, environmental health indicators. She has authored numerous scientific publications. She previously served with the United States EPA as a senior scientist and policy advisor in the Office of Public Policy, Economics, and Innovation. She's an associate editor and member of the Editorial Advisory Board on Environmental Health Perspectives. And with that, I want to welcome Dr. Woodruff, especially in light of the fact that I've got young children and I've got one due in August. So with that, I pay particular attention to that, Dr. Woodruff.
Heading event. Welcome everyone. I am from the University of California, San Francisco, and just to give you a little bit of background on the work we do, we are a research program. We focus on understanding exposures to environmental chemicals during pregnancy and how that might affect development, but also at UCSF, because we're a medical sciences institution and we're very interested in promoting the best health for women and their families. We also work on translating not only the information we have on science, but also the information available generally on science in terms of how do we improve clinical care, so improve the patient-doctor relationship and the information that they're getting about toxic chemicals, as well as improving public policy. So this is why we are having concerns about exposure to environmental chemicals, and that is because we are seeing disturbing changes in chronic conditions among children in the U.S. population. So today, we know from data that's collected by the federal government that 1 in 6 children in the United States have been reported to be diagnosed with a developmental condition. And what do I mean by that? I mean autism, attention deficit and activity, hyperactivity disorder, as well as other types of neurological conditions. And in fact, we've seen an increase in the rates of autism across the United States that has been reported over the last 10 to 15 years. Now, some people might say, well, isn't this because doctors are diagnosing it more and there's been a change in the way that people view autism? Well, what has happened is that the federal government, the Centers for Disease Control, actually got concerned about this. Like, maybe there is a change in the way that diagnoses are happening. And they went out into several locations in the United States, used the same criteria to diagnose autism, and then followed it over in time. And what they found was there actually is an increasing rate of autism among these children that cannot be explained by changing diagnosis by physicians. So increases in developmental disorders such as autism and reported increases in attention deficit hyperactivity disorder are just one of several conditions that we're seeing increasing in childhood. These also include increasing rates of asthma, which have been reported and have doubled since the 70s and continue to slightly increase since they changed the reporting criteria. We're also seeing changes in obesity. There's been an increase in the rates of obesity among children in the United States. And so These trends, which have been reported by the federal government in different types of surveys, lead to a concern that we can't have genetics that are changing in 20 years. That just would not explain the cheap increases we're seeing in these childhood conditions. So something outside children and outside us must be contributing to these increases that we're seeing in terms of chronic conditions in childhood. And so one thing that we are very interested in understanding is the role of industrial chemicals as a risk factor for some of these not only increases in chronic conditions we're seeing during childhood, but also some of the conditions and increases we're seeing in adulthood as well. And this is from data that we published at the University of California, San Francisco. It's data that's collected by the Federal Reserve Board, and it's a report on U.S. chemical production starting from the 1940s. And you can see that U.S. chemical production in the United States has increased dramatically since the 1940s, over 15-fold. During the same time, and we're also seeing this increasing rate of chronic conditions. Now, can there be many things that contribute to whether a child gets autism, ADHD, obesity, asthma? Yes. But the role of environmental chemicals is one risk factor that is both understudied, and when we look at it, it's in many ways underappreciated, and is a preventable risk factor in terms of if you stop the exposure, you can prevent the exposure to the chemical, and you can increase, you can improve health. So just to give you a context for the state of industrial chemicals in the United States, there are many different types of industrial chemicals that are manufactured and used in everyday products that we have in our everyday lives. So the data show that there's about 80,000 chemicals that are registered for use by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Now that doesn't mean they're necessarily used in commerce, but there are several thousand, 3,000, that are used or imported in greater than 1 million pounds, meaning that, and some of them are in billions of pounds. So what that means is that there are many different industrial chemicals for which there is an opportunity to be somewhere in our daily lives in which we can come into contact with. And there are numerous industrial chemicals that are introduced into commerce every year. So where are these? So there are chemicals in the air we breathe, in the food we eat, the water we drink, and there are also chemicals that are found in everyday products, things like personal care products, shampoos, hand lotions, conditioners, things that are cleaning products, things, the building materials that are used in your home, kinds of things that are used in food packaging or lining of cans. Chemicals are used to make many of the different products that we have in our everyday life. And subsequently, one of the things that we have a concern about is, while we know that chemicals are important because we can use them in different products, we also have a concern, though, because for many of these chemicals, we actually don't have little to no information about whether they may pose a risk to us or to our families if we come into contact with them. One of the things that's very critical is that there is now a great understanding about the importance of development, particularly during the prenatal period and early during childhood, because it sets the stage for the future health, not only of that child, but also the future adult. And that makes sense, right? If you start off with two strands of two eggs, one sperm from your dad, the egg from your mother, they come together, they form a cell, divide, and they're going through many different changes during the prenatal period. Your limbs are forming, your brain is forming, your gut is forming, your lungs, your heart, all the different organs. And these are very tightly orchestrated processes. And if you interrupt them during development, or you reprogram them through some type of external influence, you can actually reprogram the fate of the development. And that can result in something that may adversely occur at birth, maybe a birth defect. Maybe it may not manifest until childhood. Maybe it influences your risk for asthma or neurodevelopmental conditions. It may not even appear until adulthood. So this is from some data that we published at the University of California, San Francisco. So one of the questions we have is, okay, we know that industrial chemicals are used to make many different products. We know these products are in many different places in our everyday life. We know that we can come into contact with them. And we know that the exposures that occur, particularly during developmental periods, may be important. What are these exposures that are occurring? Well, this is from a study we published couple years ago, looking at data that's collected by the federal government. So the federal government does a national survey called the biomonitoring survey. They basically go out and select a representative sample of the U.S. population because they want to understand the health and welfare of the U.S. population. And they collect biological samples. That means they collect urine and blood. And then they measure them for different things. They measure them for something that your doctor might measure you for, but they also measure them for different types of industrial chemicals. And so when we looked at this data for, well, what does it say for pregnant women, we found that pregnant women are exposed and measured different industrial chemicals that are commonly found in the marketplace. And that in fact, there are 43 different chemicals that are found in 99 to 100% of pregnant women. What that means is that pregnant women are carrying a burden of industrial chemical exposures of at least 43 different chemicals to which various other things are added that different groups of women are exposed to. So what are some of these chemicals? Some of them have been banned. Things like polychlorinated bright metals, DDT. There are still DDT measured in pregnant women today. And that's because some of these chemicals, once they get out into the environment, they have a structure or property that makes them essentially hang around so that they continue to persist, they get into the food chain, and then we and pregnant women are exposed to them. Some of these chemicals are things like that you may be familiar with that are found in plastics, BPA, phthalates. Other chemicals are perfluorinated chemicals, which are used in fabrics and food packaging. So the concern we then have is that, okay, we know that pregnant women are come into contact with these chemicals. We know we can find these industrial chemicals in pregnant women. And we also know that these chemicals can pass from the placenta and enter the fetus. And so what we now know is that the fetus is actually exposed, even before birth, to numerous different industrial chemicals. And now we have, I'm not going to go over all the science because there's actually several authoritative bodies who've reviewed the science about if we have exposures to many of these industrial chemicals, many of them which are known to adversely impact reproduction development, so PCBs, DDT, lead, mercury. What do we know about the state of the science in terms of exposure to these chemicals and how they may, what their implications are for reproduction and development? So these are three reports that have been published by authoritative bodies. And what do I mean by that? This is the one on the left is from the Endocrine Society. It's not an environmental health group. This is a professional society that represents endocrinologists, people who do research and who actually are clinicians who deal in the field of endocrinology. The second report in the middle is from the World Health Organization, jointly published by the World Health Organization and the United Nations Environment Program. The report on the right is published by the President's Cancer Panel, which is sponsored by the National Cancer Institute and was a panel that was appointed by the President, actually this panel was appointed by President George Bush. And each of these reports review the state of exposure to environmental chemicals and how they may, and what are the implications for effects on reproduction, development, or in the case on the right, cancer. And each of the reports conclude that the science is robust for a concern about exposure to these different types of industrial chemicals and their effects on reproduction and development. And I will refer you to something that came out just last October, which actually is a handout in the back, which I think summarizes what each of these different reports say. So this is a committee opinion from the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. This is a professional society that represents physicians who are obstetricians and gynecologists. They deal in healthcare for women, and they also deal, they're the primary physician that you would see if you're pregnant. The other professional society that was part of this committee opinion is the American Society of Reproductive Medicine, another healthcare provider organization that is concerned about providing science and clinical care related to reproductive health. And then because they became concerned about the exposures to industrial chemicals and the implications that it had for their patients, that they did a committee opinion, which is essentially a review of the science and represents what the professional societies think about the relationship between environmental chemical exposures and reproductive and development health. And their conclusion, which is very similar to the other documents I just talked about, is that the evidence that links exposure to toxic environmental agents and adverse reproductive and developmental health outcomes is sufficiently robust. They further further conclude that environmental exposures can have profound and lasting impact on the health of our patients and future generations. I just want to take a pause here, but I have I've been doing research on environmental chemicals for 20 plus years, as the introduction said. I used to work at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, so some of these things are very familiar to us in terms of industrial chemicals. We have exposures. Many of these chemicals can increase risk for a number of different adverse health outcomes. But what is remarkable is that they aren't trained in environmental health. They don't work in the field of environmental health, but they are concerned about exposure to environmental chemicals and what the implications are, not only for their patients, but the families of their patients. I think that is a remarkable shift in the conversation about environmental chemical exposures. So I just want to talk a little bit about some of the policy pieces. And this is from West Virginia. So if you may be familiar with this, if you lived in West Virginia, in Charleston, or any of the 9 surrounding counties, and you woke up on January 10th, you would have received the news from the governor that you should not drink your water. Unless you do not drink your water, you should not touch your water. You should not use it to wash. You should not use it to bathe. And the reason that the residents in West Virginia were told this is because there was a chemical spill that occurred upstream from their water treatment plant. From this chemical, this is the first one that was discovered, which is MCHM. Chemical that's used to in the processing of coal. The thing about it was it also smelled a little bit like licorice. But some of the residents noticed that their water smelled like licorice, so they called up the government. The government went to the plant. They see, oh my gosh, there's all this stuff coming out of the plant, it's going into the river. They immediately, okay, we have a problem. We're going to tell the residents, because we don't know about this chemical and it's in their drinking water, to basically not drink it, shower, or wash it. You can flush your toilet bowl. So the next thing you would say is, okay, if we're dealing with this industrial chemical, which it is, it's a chemical that's actually registered under the Toxic Substances Control Act, say, okay, how do we know? Because we have our residents, we can come into contact with this. What's the toxicity of this chemical? So the first thing you would do, if you're a government official or a physician, is you would go to the material safety data sheet. This is a sheet of information that's used that is supposed to contain all the information that is available on the chemical about its physical properties, what you should do if you come into contact with it, what's the potential for it to adversely impact health. So this is the material safety data sheet that was first available on this chemical. And I just would say that under the tox data, which is that's the data that someone might use to figure out whether it's a health problem, that's not available. There's no data on whether it's a carcinogen. There's no data on whether it's a reproductive developmental toxicant. There's no data that can give you anything from which to make a decision about this chemical. So then it's like, okay, well, actually, there's another material safety data sheet that comes available shortly after that. It actually was somewhat held under confidential business information. Now, this particular material safety data sheet did have a number for toxicity. Was the amount that you would have to give rats to kill half of them. So this is the number that the government used to make a decision about what they should set the safety level for cleaning up the river, the water intake for the West Virginia spill. Okay, so first problem is they really have very little data to do this, and it took more time to get it because some of that information was being held by the company. So okay, the 13th comes. Residents are told, okay, we've done what we're going to do. The water is now at a safe level to drink. Tuesday happens, but on Wednesday, the governor comes back and says, we have to revise our drinking water standards because we didn't account for the fact that pregnant women are going to be drinking this water and that they may be more sensitive to the effects of exposure to this chemical. And the CDC actually changed the recommendation and said, you should not come into contact with pregnant women, should not be coming into contact with this water until there's no measurable amounts of this chemical in the water. And then 6 days after the spill, then publicly, the company releases a little bit more more information about the potential toxicity of this chemical. It is a study that was done on adult female and male rats so that they have some information about sort of what it might do to an adult, but there's still no data available on how this might affect development, for example, if you expose a child or there's exposure that occurs during pregnancy. So, and the other thing I will note is that this data didn't become publicly available until 6 days after the spill happened. And so what that's because really the way that chemicals are handled now is pretty whole because it's governed by the Toxic Substances Control Act, which is from 1976. Okay, I showed this slide last night. Some people didn't know that was Jerry Ford. He's the president, and then that's George Harrison. He was in the Beatles. And if you don't know who the Beatles were, they're a famous band from the 60s. So that's the point of this. If you don't know who they are, you certainly aren't going to know the Toxic Substances Control Act. That's really old. But the point is that the Toxic Substances Control Act, which governs industrial chemicals, is a very old bill, and it's really not up to the modern day standards that we need in order to evaluate industrial chemicals. And so MCHM, which is the chemical that was in the West Virginia spill, it was grandfathered in under TSCA, and any chemical that was grandfathered in under TSCA does not have any requirements for safety testing unless there's certain very high bars met. And so as you can see, it puts the government in a very difficult position because if people are exposed to these chemicals, they really don't know how to evaluate it because they can't even make a basic decision about the toxicity of the chemical that people can come into contact with. And so one of the challenges is that even though there's thousands of these chemicals that are used on the marketplace, we actually only have data on a very small fraction of them because TSCA does not adequately require testing information either for the chemicals that are already on the marketplace or the new ones that are entering the marketplace. And so, us is why these health professional societies are beginning to more engage on the issue of environmental chemicals. They see that their patients are exposed to industrial chemicals. They know that they can have implications for reproduction and development, and they are concerned about what the role of these chemicals are, not only in the health of their patients, but in the health of their patients' families and the U.S. population. So ACOG, ASRM, has also joined the American Academy of Pediatrics and the Society for Maternal and Fetal Medicine. They have been actively engaged in reforming TSCA, which is an active debate that's going on right now in Washington, D.C., to update the Toxic Substances Control Act. Because everyone, all the stakeholders agree, the chemical industry, U.S. EPA, as well as environmental groups, that the Toxic Substances Control Act is very old and it needs to be updated to meet the modern day challenges of industrial chemical use. This is a letter that was sent by these four professional societies to the leadership of the Energy and Commerce Committee, basically saying, we need you to update TSCA, and we need it to have be sufficient in order to understand both risks to pregnant women and to be sufficiently protective of pregnant women and their families. And I just want to talk briefly about environmental chemical regulation. I know that this can be a very heated debate because people think that there's a conflict between environmental chemical regulation and the economy. And I'll just show this slide, which is from US EPA, which is the effectiveness of the Clean Air Act. The Clean Air Act requires that US EPA set standards and enforce standards on six criteria air pollutants, particulate matter, ozone, lead, CO, NOx, and SOx. This is also part of the Clean Air Act, where US EPA and the federal government have evaluated and calculated the benefits of the Clean Air Act, which, as you can see, is $2 trillion by 2020. And the other thing that's very interesting about this is that the levels of these six criteria air pollutants, particularly PM and ozone, have gone down over the last 20 years. Wow. Drive more, there's more people in the U.S., the economy has grown, and we're seeing an increase in energy consumption. So you can actually grow the economy and achieve environmentally friendly results. and it's been proven by the Clean Act. One other thing I want to say, because I know this is a legislative body, is that the U.S. government actually does a report every year out of the Office of Management and Budget, which looks at the cost and benefits of all federal regulations in the U.S. government. And I'll just tell you that the number one benefit among any regulatory agencies is the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, by far. And the benefits always outweigh the cost, mostly because of the Clean Air Act. So, lastly, I'd like to just end with a quote from Dr. Connery, who's now the president of the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. And she's an obstetrician. She's been practicing for many years. And her note to, and this, she's standing actually in Washington, D.C., with Dr. Linda Judy, who's chair of the Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences at UCSF, and is also the president of the SRM. And what they note is that they're concerned about exposure to industrial chemicals and the effect it may have on their patients. Now, I have handouts in the back about people are, after they hear this talk, right, like, okay, that's so worried, I wonder what I can do. And there are things you can do, but the other message is that there are some things that are not possible to do either because they're beyond our control or we don't have the information to do it. And that we have to think about the burden of proof. And as Dr. Connery says, we have to shift the burden of proof off of our patients, off of our clinicians, to put it onto the manufacturers. So they have to prove that their chemicals are safe prior to use on the marketplace. And with that, I am happy to take any questions. The program on reproductive health and the environment is works to support the initiatives of both understanding the science about the environment and how it affects reproduction development, but also is very active in translating that information so it's useful not only for clinicians, but as well as policymakers. So thank you.
Yes, what kind of statistical modeling is being developed to assist an environmental toxicologist to actually measure reality out of chatter for issues including the coal example you gave? Are we following those things?
In terms of how we evaluate the toxicity from environmental chemicals, this, you evaluate the weight or the strength of evidence. If you are in this field, that's very, that's kind of the language that's tossed around. But say that is actually being very actively evaluated right now, both at US EPA and at the National Toxicology Program, as well as internationally in Europe. I think one of the challenges that we've had in the past is that we haven't had, or we have methods to do this, but they have had significant challenges to them. The National Academy of Sciences actually put out a report in 2008 that looked at the methods, what you're saying, as risk assessment, essentially how do we evaluate risks from exposure to environmental chemicals. And they noted that risk assessment, pretty similar to TSCA, hasn't really, the methods have not been updated since the 1970s. And they actually laid out a number of different recommendations about how EPA, as well as other regulatory bodies, should update their methods for risk assessment. Some of those include, you know, a lot of the risks are evaluated by take a chemical, we expose an animal, we look at the health effect. People aren't exposed to one chemical. They're exposed to many chemicals, so EPA needs to account for that. They need to account for the fact that exposures that occur during sensitive periods may have a higher risk or a more susceptible risk. And then also people are different, right? Like some people might be sick, some people are healthy. You know, you can't just assume that exposure.
A single chemical. They combine, they work differently,
right.
and to model that in a modern statistical fashion, beyond what I see in the medical industry, is a substantial task. But it's a much more global look at it. You know, where in the world are these chemicals not in existence? Where do they exist? How are they reacting? It's you're talking a database in millions, so it could really lead you to try and link, if you have something like autism, is it a broad spectrum issue? Is it a single trigger out there somewhere in the environment that we should pay attention to? And a lot of parents go to single triggers. What the latest one I read on the internet was MSG. So glutamate. If we get rid of that, you can stop and reverse autism.
Yes, I have heard that too. I would just say, I mean, we could talk offline because there's a lot of different nuances in how you do risk assessment. And, you know, part of it is you have single chemical exposures. Part of it is how do you look at, how do you reverse engineer? How you're going to look at autism and how you're going to look at the exposure. That's a kind of a little bit different question than let's expose rats and see how many different kinds of cancers they get. That's a different way to look at it. So I'm happy to talk to you offline.
We've done a lot of work on this, but it's a little bit complicated to answer here. Yes? The 43 toxic chemicals in pregnant women, where do they generally come from? What sources?
Well, some of them are legacy chemicals, so bichlorinated biphenyl. So those were used in bans in the 70s, DDT, ban in the 60s. Some of them are newer chemicals, so polybrominated biphenyl ethers. Those are recently used, but some of them are banned by California, phased out nationally. For fluorinated chemicals, those are used now. Those are chemicals that are used in like nonstick applications. They're like Teflon chemicals. They're used a lot in food packaging. Two of them have been phased out, but there's several replacements that are behind them. There's a group of chemicals called phthalates, which are plasticizers. Those are used in to make hard plastic soft. So they're used in vinyl flooring. They're used in also used in personal care products because they can convey a scent. And they're used in different kinds of plastic applications. There's a few pesticides that were measured at relatively high levels, and there are several polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, which are just like an air pollutant that comes from food. Those are the like high prevalent ones. Oh, and I think perchlorate, that is also found in everybody in the United States. That's a rocket fuel additive, and it's a water contaminant. It's gotten into the food supply because it's used to irrigate, it's in the water supply that's used to irrigate food, and then it's uptaken through lettuce, milk, et cetera. So people get exposed probably through eating food. So it's like a kind of a variety of different things. I just would say that one other thing is that, you know, it's about, NHANES measures about 200 plus, they can measure about 200 plus chemicals. I said there's 3,000 sort of high use, so there's, you know, there's another 2,000 that we just aren't even measuring because we aren't really, maybe then we're not exposed to them, but maybe we are. So we actually at UCSF have been developing some technology to do a more sort of high throughput scan of chemical exposures so we can get a better idea about, well, are we really capturing all the potential exposures that might be out there or not? Because we're a little bit kind of looking at a fraction of the picture. We have a database of chemicals that we're using for these blood scans for, like I said, these toxic chemicals, so we're always looking at things to add. So this way, say the government does not keep a actually user-friendly version of all the chemicals. They keep a registration of the toxic inventory, but I would say that it's not amenable to keep just a general public doing it and using it in a way that...
Do you have a business card?
What?
Do you have a business card?
Yes. Yes, I do. Yes, I did bring one.
Yes, could you say a little bit more about some of the neurodevelopmental toxicants, such as the flame retardants?
Yeah, sure. So the polychlorinated biphenyl ethers, one of their concerns is that they're linked to adverse effects on neurodevelopment. We actually did a study which actually aggregated studies that had been done across different studies of humans and found that there was a relationship between PCBs and IQ. We're also concerned about polybrominated diphenyl ethers because they're kind of a replacement for the PCBs. And so people have looked at these chemicals and originally were concerned because they looked at studies in rats, animals, and saw that prenatal exposure was associated with effects on neurodevelopment. Thought to be a mechanism that is through altering thyroid hormones, which is important for neurodevelopment. But now we have two studies that have been published on polybrominated diphenyl ethers looking at prenatal exposures and decrements in IQ. IQ is kind of a crude marker for neurocognitive function. And these studies were done, one was in New York City, one was in California. 3,000 miles apart, but yet they saw a remarkably similar relationship between the prenatal exposures to PBDE. So increasing levels of PBDE led to decreases in IQ. And actually, the strength of the association, meaning the relationship between the two, was pretty strong. It's actually relatively similar to what we might see for lead. So we're actually working on a project now to aggregate this information to get a better handle on it. But it does give us pause about some of these modern chemical exposures, which are more recent. Because lead, we think that, well, we already know about lead, we already dealt with lead. But some of these more newer ones may be adversely impacting neurodevelopment that we have not fully uncovered.
Do you want to mention
the movie? Do you want to mention the movie?
I think the problem is this one question. Are there more questions? Or?
There's been some interesting articles out on multi-generational issues regarding DNA.
Epigenetics.
Yes.
Yeah, altering your. So, yeah, so we didn't really get into the details, but you know, you have your DNA, it decodes many of your functions, but how the DNA unfolds and replicate is governed by epigenetics, so all the different kind of attempts. It's a little bit like a computer, right? You have your hardware, which is your DNA, and then you have your software, which is your epigenetics. And so now, and the epigenetic, this kind of software piece is transmitted from generation to generation. But there's some evidence that suggests that, there's definitely data that suggests you can alter this computer code so that you can change how the DNA are turning on and off. And that this may be transmitted not just to from exposures from the pregnancy down to your child, but then that child can grow up and transmit that effect to the next generation. Actually, that makes some sense, right? Because if you have a fetal exposure and the fetus is developing, whether it's a girl or a boy, their reproductive tract is developing, you can affect their future either ovaries or their male reproductive function that can then transmit again when they grow up.
Thank you, Tracy.
Sure.
Thank you all for coming today. My name is Pam Miller. I work with Alaska Community Action on Autism. And we'd like to also invite you to a lecture that Dr. Woodruff will be giving this evening at 6:30 at the Goldtown Nickelodeon Theater, 6:30. And then we're going to have a screening of a very fine documentary film called Toxic Hot Seat, which is an award-winning film about the effects of some of these flame retardant chemicals that are used in everyday products. We actually have a short trailer for the film to show you right now. It just takes about 5 more minutes. So we really appreciate you coming this afternoon, and we also are here to support Senator Olson's bill, Senate Bill 151, the Toxic Food Children's Act. So thanks again.
Let's see. I'm going to show you the volume. We need to set the mic next.
Everyone has a fear of fire, right? Almost a burnout of fire.
The temperature rises and rises until suddenly everything is burning. We have developed a method for applying a flame retardant in the home. Every American home has flame retardants in their couch. These are chemicals measured by pounds and ounces.
Thank you.
Professional Firefighters Association, because as firefighters, they're on the front line of exposure to chemicals like flame retardants, especially. So they're very supportive of our, you know, bills like SB151, which includes a ban of the latest form of flame retardant, so which is free. I guess thank you for coming, and hope you can make it tonight. And Tracy, before the film at 6:30, Tracy is also going to speak. So.
Even though the film is at the Gold Town, it's free.
Yes.
First come, first serve. So invite friends and family and whoever might be interested.